So last week we finished up 2 Samuel 14, which was the sad incident with Amnon and Tamar. And as you remember, Absalom killed Amnon. Amnon was David's firstborn. Absalom, I believe, was number 3 in the list. But Absalom, after he killed his brother, of course, fled to his grandfather and stayed there for a couple, 3 years. And then finally, Joab engineered getting him back. And even after he was back, he was in local exile, burning Joab's field down to get his attention, and finally got in to see David. Now, what we're going to see tonight is the beginning of the downfall of Absalom, because he is going to conspire to depose his father. We're going to see, as we read through this, a number of characters, and their backstory is extremely pertinent to everything that's going on. I have no idea what was going through Absalom's head. His grandfather is the king of a small kingdom to the east of the Jordan. So his mother was a princess, quote unquote. I would expect that probably she groomed him for power. So the idea that he wants to be king is perfectly normal. I'm sure every son of the king would like to succeed him. So that's okay. But I also think, since he was willing to have his father killed in order to depose him, I think that part of what's going on in his mind, and this is just a guess, I mean, there's no scripture to support this whatsoever, has to do with the way David handled the business with the rape of his sister. Because it says in there that when David found out about it, he was very angry, but it doesn't say he did anything. And what we're going to see here is Absalom is going to set himself up as a rival to the king. And I cannot believe, with all of the stuff that we're going to see that he's doing, that David doesn't get word of this. But again, David doesn't seem to rebuke him, doesn't seem to give him any advice, doesn't seem to say, okay, I see what you're doing here, but you need to wait your turn. There doesn't appear to be anything until such time as David looks up and, oh my gosh, I've got to flee Jerusalem. Similarly, it appears that David didn't say anything to Amnon. One of the things I started off this series with is Kay and I watched a series on Hillsdale College by one of their professors on David. And his comment was that David was, quite frankly, not a very good father. So reading between the lines here, he doesn't jerk Absalom up and say, wait a minute, what do you think you're doing, kid? Not your turn. I've still got 5 more years to go before I'm ready to abdicate. Nor does he apparently do anything with Amnon. Nor does he apparently do anything with Absalom. Because Absalom, remember, kills Amnon, flees to his grandfather. David apparently just leaves him there for 3 years. And then when he comes back, just has him in an internal exile and doesn't ever talk to him. All of this is by way of commenting on David's style as a father, which doesn't appear to be very good. The comment there was that you've got principal wives in David's harem. He's got a number of concubines and so forth. But it appears that Absalom's mom is a power player. And certainly we see every indication that Bathsheba is a power player. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Adonijah's mother is a power player, because he'll be the next one that takes a try at this. The point of this whole thing is David does not seem to discipline his sons. The result of that, of course, is what we're going to see tonight and what we saw last time, where Amnon raped his half-sister and gets murdered by his half-brother. And we'll see more of that tonight. And the other thing that's going on, obviously, is, of course, you remember when Nathan jerked David up because of the sin with Bathsheba. He said several things. He said, you're going to have trouble within your own house. He says, your own family is going to turn on you. And we'll see all of that beginning to happen. Having said all that about David and his sons and so forth, now we'll go into the sad incident with Absalom. So, chapter 15. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom was called to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "Your servant is of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "Your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were judge in the land, that every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." Whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. So he's outside the gate of Jerusalem. He's got an entourage of 50 guys around his chariot. He is saying, "You're coming up here and you're not going to get real justice, parenthesis, because my dad is no good." That's sort of the message. There is nobody who is going to give you good justice. My dad is no good, or my dad is incompetent, or whatever. So what we really want is somebody like me to be the judge, and I would give you justice. Now, given where this is happening, given that he's got 50 guys around him, there is just no way that David doesn't know about it. This is obviously what would be called today sedition, and the fact that he doesn't jerk this kid up short, I mean kid, he's obviously a mature young man, but the fact that he doesn't either put a stop to it or say, "You're right, you're my successor, let me take you under my wing and I'll groom you so that when I'm ready to step down, you're going to be the king." In other words, have patience. Doesn't do either one of those things. So I'm thinking that this is, again, another indicator of his way of fathering. 7. And at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur in Aram, saying, 'If the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' So he arose and went to Hebron." So this behavior of his has been going on for 4 years. There just isn't any way that news of what's going on would not have gotten back to David and his advisors. So he's going to leave town, and obviously what he's going to do is, when he's out of town, he is going to solidify his rebellion. Verse 10. But Absalom sent secret messengers throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, 'Absalom is king at Hebron.'" Now, notice two things. Thing one is he does this away from Jerusalem. As I say, I can't believe that David doesn't know what's going on, but he does not do this at Jerusalem. And the second thing, of course, is Hebron is where David started his regal career. So he's going back to Judah's hometown in Hebron, and he's setting himself up there. Verse 11. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited guests, and they went in their innocence and knew nothing. And while Absalom was offering some sacrifices, he sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city in Gilon. And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. All right, Ahithophel. There's your first major player. Ahithophel has been David's advisor, I'm sure, since he was in the wilderness. Ahithophel is the grandfather of Bathsheba. And Ahithophel goes with Absalom. And I am of the opinion that Ahithophel never got over the adultery and the murder of his grandson-in-law. So Ahithophel is going with Absalom, verse 13. And a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly, and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. A couple of things going on here. The first thing is, I don't know whether he doesn't know the extent of Absalom's strength or whether he does know the extent of Absalom's strength. The other thing that David does not want to have happen is a battle over Jerusalem. He does not want this to be a siege of the city with all of the attendant death and misery that that would cause. So what he does is he picks everybody up and he leaves. Could be because he either doesn't know or does know how strong Absalom is. If he doesn't know how strong he is, all right, I'll get out of the city, see what develops, and then perhaps go back. Or if he does know how strong Absalom is, he says, I can't beat him and I don't want to have a fight here, so I will flee. The 200 guests went unawares. Absalom has been building up support throughout all of Israel. And what he's saying is, when you hear the shofar blow, I want everybody to come and say Absalom is king. So he is going to draw an army from the entirety of Israel. These 200 guys that are at the sacrifice, they go there unaware of what's about to happen. They're not his 200-man army. He's going to have a considerably larger force when he goes after his father. 15, and the king's servant said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. So the king went out and all his household after him, and the king left 10 concubines to keep the house. And the king went out and all the people after him, and they halted at the last house. And all the servants passed by him, and all the Cherethites and all the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had followed him from Gath passed on before the king. All right, so what he's got is he's got his nucleus of all of his mighty men. They're all going with him. So he has got the nucleus of a very capable army. Now, having said that, these guys are getting old. They aren't the 20-year-old bucks that they were when they were in Gath. They're considerably older. So you know, you've got well-experienced, brave men, but the flip side of that is they're not young bucks anymore. Verse 19. Then the king said to Ittai the Gittite, why do you also go with us? Go back and stay with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your home. You came only yesterday, and shall I today make you wander about with us? Since I go, I know not where. Go back and take your brothers with you, and may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you. A couple of things, obviously. One is, just as he said, this guy is brand new here, and to get him involved in the fight would be not great. The other thing is, he doesn't know this guy. The mighty men that he has with him have been with him for years, and he knows them all. This Ittai just sort of showed up all of a sudden. He's unproven, untested. So if I have to run off into the wilderness and perhaps fight a guerrilla war, I don't know this guy. He may be a great guy, he may not. I just don't know. Either one of those things could be going on. 21. But Ittai answered the king, as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king shall be, whether for death or for life, there also will your servant be. And David said to Ittai, go then, pass on. So Ittai the Gittite, and Gittite is from Gath, by the way. That's what that means. So Ittai the Gittite passed on with all his men and all the little ones who were with him. So he's got a band of men with him, don't know how big, and he's also got his family, sort of again like what David was doing down in Ziklag when he was traveling around down there. 22. And all the land wept aloud as all the people passed by. And the king crossed the brook Kidron, and all the people passed on toward the wilderness. And Abiathar came up, and behold, Zadok, came also with all the Levites bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God. And they set down the Ark of God until the people had passed out of the city. So he's got the religious establishment, both Abiathar and Zadok are priests. And they've picked up the Ark of God and said, all right, we're going with you. Obviously a big symbolic move. And it's interesting, this is almost a replay of Joshua crossing the Jordan. Because remember, Joshua takes the ark and puts it in the middle of the Jordan and all of Israel passes by. So these two priests have got the ark and they're setting it there until everybody with David passes by. Obviously a symbolic thing that would have great meaning to all those involved. Verse 25. Then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me see both it and its dwelling place. But if he says, I have no pleasure in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. This is typical David, and one of the reasons why God said David is a man after my own heart, because David says, yeah, my son has risen in rebellion against me, but it's God who's going to decide this. I'm putting myself in God's hands, and however he decides, that's how it's going to be. Very typical of David, and that I think is one of the reasons that God, no matter how he sins, and he does sin a lot, always stays with him, because when he gets himself in trouble, he always turns back to God. Comment was that what's happening here is something that Nathan predicted. And the interesting thing here is, no matter which way this turns out, it is going to be devastating for David. If David is killed, of course, that's the end of it, and we're done. But if David prevails, then he's got to deal with Absalom. So no matter which way this goes, David is not going to be a happy camper and be an even less happy king. 27. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? Go back to the city in peace with your two sons, Ahimaaz your son and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait at the fords in the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. So Zadok and Abiathar carried the Ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. So these two guys are priests. They're loyal to David. So David wants them in the city so that he can have intelligence about what's actually going on. And we'll see in a few minutes that once the situation starts to shake out, the two sons of the two priests will go find David and let him know what's happened. So David is leaving back their trusted people who can give him intelligence and so forth. Verse 30. But David went up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went, barefoot, with his head covered, and all the people who were with him covered their heads. And they went up weeping as they went. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness, because Ahithophel is one of the wisest of David's counselors. So the idea that Ahithophel has gone over to the rebellion is a major blow to David. 32. While David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai, the Archite, came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. David said to him, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, as I have been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. So Hushai, and I don't know what having his coat torn and dirt on his head means. Just don't really answer that. Maybe he's in mourning, tore his garment and put dust on his head. But the other thing, you will be a burden to me, indicates to me that he's an old man. And really don't want to have him trucking through the wilderness with us, because he's more of a burden than help. Where you can be of help to me is to go back, insert yourself into Absalom's confidence, and be a counterweight to Ahithophel, which of course he will do. So David leaving, if you will, landmines back there for his son. 35. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So what he's saying is, you will not be the only one who's doing this. You will be doing it, as will the two priests. So you're going to sort of be my intelligence nucleus back there. So are not Zadok and Abiathar the priest with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. Behold, their two sons are with them, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. And by them you shall send to me everything you hear. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. Obviously, David is setting things up so that as he gets out into the wilderness, he's got the nucleus of a very fine army, having all of his palace guard, if you will, with him. And by the way, the idea of having your palace guard with you can be a comic thing, but in David's case, these are actual seasoned warriors as opposed to ceremonial guards. And of course, he's leaving some trusted advisors back there with the mission of letting him know what's going on, and oh, by the way, see if you can feed Absalom some bad advice and get him to do something dumb. And as I say, I can't help but think that grabbing Absalom by the stacking swivel 5 years ago and sorting him out would have been a whole lot less painful. Chapter 16. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why have you brought these?" Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." And the king said, "And where is your master's son?" Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem. For he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" And the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours." And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." You all remember the story of Mephibosheth from a couple 3 weeks ago. Mephibosheth is Jonathan's son, who was crippled, and David expressly went to find him so that he could do him good. And he restored all of Saul's personal land, set up Ziba to manage it, and then had Mephibosheth sit at his table, highly honored. So he did everything he could to honor the memory of Saul, the memory of Jonathan, and the remainder of his household. And the first time things look like they're in turmoil, Mephibosheth pivots like a ballerina and heads to the rebellion with the hope that he will then be able to somehow get himself into power. And again, the thing that it says here, he hopes that his father's kingdom will be returned to him. Now, Absalom is not about to restore the kingdom of Saul. However, what we've got here is a rebellion, and there's going to be chaos, and nobody knows how it's going to shake out. David may win, Absalom may win, or they may kill each other. So in all that chaos, there is the potential of an opportunity for the grandson of the former king to go back into power. I am guessing that's what he's thinking. Certainly going with David doesn't give him any such opportunity because David has done all that he can for him. Doesn't know how Absalom is going to shake out, but there may come then an opportunity. So he doesn't go with David. He goes with Absalom, I think, waiting to see what possibilities develop. And of course, David is kind of grumpy about that and tells his servant, Ziba, who is a good guy. I mean, again, think about this. This whole thing is happening in a very short time span. So David gets the word Absalom's on his way. David gathers up all of his household and heads out of there. And in the time it takes David to get out of Jerusalem and to the Mount of Olives, Ziba has collected and delivered all of this stuff. It is not insubstantial. So he's a good manager, obviously, and he's loyal. Verse 5, when King David came to Bahurim, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of the king. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, get out, you man of blood, you worthless man. The Lord has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood. Now, back in 1 Samuel, one of the things that I remarked on fairly regularly was how skillful David was politically to not appear to be taking advantage of the problems with the house of Saul. Saul died in battle, as did Jonathan. Then his son sets up a rump kingdom at Mahanaim. And David does not go after him. And it's only when Abner gets upbraided by Rehoboam for taking one of Saul's concubines that Abner changes sides. And then Joab, of course, kills Abner. And then some of Rehoboam's own people assassinate Rehoboam and bring David his head. David has them killed. So David has, I think, at least as scripture is written, done his very level best not to pile on when Saul dies. However, Shimei doesn't see it that way. Shimei obviously sees David as a usurper, and at this point probably thinks Mephibosheth should be king. And David is a man of blood, there's no question about that. But Shimei is a Benjaminite, so he's a kinsman of Saul's, and he has obviously not gotten over the fact that God moved the kingdom from Saul to David. Verse 9, then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head. But the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? The sons of Zeruiah, by the way, we're talking about Joab is a son of Zeruiah. Joab's got two brothers, Joab and two brothers. And they're all sons of Zeruiah. And they are, to say the least, power players and power hungry. So anyway, Abishai, who was a brother of Joab, said, let me go kill this guy. But David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? So the fact that I've got Absalom after me is bad enough. This guy is a minor annoyance compared to the problems I've got. And again, this shows political acumen on David's part. He is still not doing what he could do to the Benjaminites and the allies of Saul. So behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjaminite? Leave him alone, let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look on the wrong done to me, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing today. So David and his men went on the road, while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, and threw stones at him and flung dust. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. Verse 15. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with them. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king." And Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, for whom the Lord and his people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain." So what he's asserting is, just as God set up David, he has set you up. And since God set it up, my duty is with you. 19. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give your counsel. What should we do?" And Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house. And all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father. And the hands of all Israel who are with you will be strengthened." So this is crossing the Rubicon, burning the boats on the beach, whatever military metaphor you want to use. But once Absalom goes into his father's concubines, there is no turning back. And Ahithophel knows that. And everybody else knows that. So when that happens, everybody is going to see that this guy is dead serious. He has no choice now but to win. It's not the case that he may change his mind or get weak-kneed or anything like that. He's got to either win or die. So that will strengthen his allies. The other thing it will do is bring the rest of Nathan's prophecy about. Because one of the things that Nathan said to David is, your own wives will be taken, and somebody else will sleep with them. And so that is what happens. David prayed that Ahithophel's counsel would be foolishness. And the comment was, this seems to be a foolish move on Absalom's part. And maybe, but a couple of things. One, Ahithophel does not want this rebellion to fail. He does not want to give Absalom any possibility of quitting, because Ahithophel, as I say, has been secretly against David ever since the incident with Bathsheba and Uriah. So one of the things he is doing is giving counsel against the house of David. If it turns out that what he says here, that everybody will be strengthened in their resolve and that goes that way, fine. Cool with me. If it turns out that it's dumb advice and the whole thing blows up in our face, that's fine too. And in fact, we'll see next time that Ahithophel gives some good advice and Hushai is able to thwart that good advice. And when Ahithophel sees that, Ahithophel commits suicide. The comment was, it seems as contrast to David's knack for diplomacy and good politics, that Absalom is going to look like kind of a jerk and a thug. And as I say, I think Ahithophel just is against David and everything having to do with David. So the fact that Absalom may look like a thug doesn't matter to Ahithophel. What he wants is the house of David to fall. And the more that fall in that is fine with him. Verse 22. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof. And Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and by Absalom. So Ahithophel was regarded as the best of the best advisors. And as it says here, if you had talked to God himself and got God's advice, that's how good Ahithophel's advice is. Now, Ahithophel has got an agenda, obviously, and his agenda does not bear David any good. Now, I don't know that he's against Absalom. Well, maybe he is. And the reason for that is he's got a great-grandson, Solomon. So Solomon is his great-grandson. Remember, he is the grandfather of Bathsheba. So he's got a dog in this fight. It may be he's trying to get everything to come apart with the hope that at some point Solomon will finally rise to the top. Or it may be that this is the best advice he's got, and it will in fact result in a strengthening resolve of those who are on Absalom's side. I don't know. But what it says here is that he is esteemed as if you had asked God himself for advice. The fact that he's esteemed that way doesn't mean his advice is that. And as I say, Absalom has no particular interest in his father's concubines that I know of. This is strictly a political move. As the mafia said, it's just business. So next week, we will finish up the sad story of Absalom and move on from there.